Welcome to Local Share Green Action Podcast. This show is produced by Go Green Locally, a 501c3 nonprofit providing tools and resources for people that are looking for ways to take even more successful local action that makes a difference for our people and our planet. I'm thrilled to be talking with someone who has dedicated more than 10 years to regenerative agriculture and native plant work, and is now bringing the passion to outreach to a truly inspiring environmental organization in Seed Bank. I'm speaking with Amy Kusch. Amy has worked in the regenerative agriculture and native plant sector with her hands in the soil, in the lab, running a nursery and farm, teaching students, writing grants, and collaborating with community peers. She holds a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Communications and a Master's degree in Agriculture Extension Education, and is pursuing plant and soil science doctoral studies. She is passionate about the health of Northeast's watersheds, plant communities, and greater ecology. Amy just recently joined the Mid-Atlantic Regional Seed Bank in August. As the new outreach liaison, her duties include outreach to the vast community of native plant material end users or consumers to understand their needs and methods of procurement through needs assessment and other tools, getting them thinking about long-term planning and projections as their needs. She is also working with the Mid-Atlantic Regional Seed Bank, developing an online marketplace where they will enlist end users to participate by posting their needs to the widest possible audience, most importantly to the commercial growers that they are beginning to work with. Amy, welcome to our show. It's so nice to be able to speak with you today.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, so I'm excited to find out more about your path of eco-action that led you to become an outreach liaison with Mid-Atlantic Regional Seed Bank and all the work you're doing. So to begin with, what sparked your interest in nature, plants, and farming initially?
Yeah, well, I was really fortunate. I feel I was fortunate to have a childhood that centered largely around exploring the forests and rivers of Western Massachusetts, where I grew up, as well as having an extended family that were and still are dairy farmers in the gorgeous upstate New York Finger Lakes region. And so I've always felt an innate connection to the green kingdom, if you will, of plants and mountains and watersheds, and really all of the beautiful and wild mysteries of nature. That is what was my jam, as the kids say, when I was younger. I was a bit of a feral child, and I was just fascinated with all that nature had to offer me as a kiddo. And that just has followed me my whole life.
I can relate. So you've worked in regenerative agriculture and native plant work for over a decade, and in so many different roles, hands in the soil, research, running a nursery and farm management, and teaching. So what originally drew you into this work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I came to building a career in earth and plant aligned work because I knew at some point, and I've been working in some capacity or another since I was 13 years old, whether that's babysitting or lifeguarding, but I knew that to have a job is one thing, and that, you know, unless I had an independent source of vast wealth somewhere, which I don't, that it would be necessary to have a job. And later on, I started to put words to that feeling. And there's great folks out there who talk about the difference between like work and good work. If you are fortunate enough to be able to find a service that you have to offer or skills that you have that line up with some need in the world, then that's incredible. And I think that I had found that. And so to be able to pursue a passion in a way that feels meaningful to me, in that I might be contributing to a greater good somehow, I knew that that's going to satiate my curiosity and my endless curiosity with the natural world. And it will also continue to provide opportunities for learning and expansion for myself as a biodiversity focused professional. And so I would say that I came to this work because it makes me happy. And I think intuitively, you know, if you find something that makes you happy, then you might be fairly decent at it, and you might be able to overcome challenges with a little more grit and bounce and determination, because it's fueling your soul. So I feel really lucky, and that is what drew me to this work, because I love this work.
Can you share what drew you to join the Mid-Atlantic Regional Seed Bank?
Yeah. So, and this kind of piggybacks on my previous response, but I'm sure many listeners have enjoyed, for example, when you zip open a tent and you're camping and you've got this morning view of wild plants, and you can hear like that morning cacophony of animals and insects, and maybe there's running water in the background, or maybe listeners have enjoyed, I don't know, lovely walks along healthy farm fields that have borders and buffers that are filled with wild forbs or flowers and grasses. And to me, the preciousness and importance of all that wild native plants symbolizes is captured in the work that MARSV does as an organization, which is conserving wild ecotype native plant species, and especially conserving that seed source for restoration projects. I think that is so vital to building and rebuilding healthier ecosystems for us and for generations beyond our lives. And that's work that I really love.
So your new role includes conducting needs assessments and then building an online marketplace for the native plant users. What problems is this marketplace trying to solve?
Yeah, so we are not only trying to create a platform, an online platform, which serves end users in the native plant material supply chain. And by that, I mean, we are hoping to be building conduits for restoration landscapers, or perhaps state agencies involved in large restoration projects, to be able to meet native ecotype seed sources and nursery growers via our platform. So we're not only trying to essentially create a solution to the problem of access, but we're also trying to figure out through this building process, what questions aren't we asking, perhaps, that other stakeholders need answers to? And where are barriers to adoption of using native ecotype seeds that we aren't seeing? This is a really vast, complex network of stakeholders across 7.5 states when we think of end users. And so we are really opening up a space for that discovery dialogue to learn more about what folks need. Why aren't they getting it? Can we create solutions creatively and collaboratively to get those materials to folks that need them? And it's a long-term process and involves a lot of relationship building. And so those are some of the problems that this marketplace is trying to solve, really, is excavating or mining to get to some of those root issues of how can we get more native ecotype seeds and plants into restoration projects at large.
So for people who might be new to the concept, why do native plant genetics specific to a region matter so much for ecological restoration?
Yeah, so native ecotype plants are plants that come from genetic stock that are specific to an ecoregion. And what that means, what that really translates to, is that particular species from that particular ecoregion has been growing in that very specific soil type, that very specific soil texture, with everything from soil pH to soil biology and many other biotic and abiotic impacts on that plant, including things like weather, precipitation regimes. So how much rain or snowpack does that specific area get or not get? There's things to consider like tree canopy. What's the litter or the organic material that's on top of the surface of the soil? What are some of the native invertebrates and pollinators and animals that are living around and in with this plant community? And so There are so many biotic, which is living, and abiotic, not living factors that influence how a plant evolves over time to develop resistance and resilience to stressors and impacts on that plant. And so when you have a species that is specific to an ecoregion, you have a species that essentially is hardy and tough, if you will. And why wouldn't a restoration practitioner want the toughest plant, right? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, we want perennial roots established beneath the soil, and we want biomass above the soil. We want green cover, and we want living roots. And so if the best bet for having more biomass below ground and above ground is a plant that has the odds stacked in its favor for survival, then why wouldn't we want to use that particular ecotype seed?
Yeah. So what do you hope that growers, landscapers, restoration groups, and maybe community projects will gain from the long-term planning around seed and plant needs?
Yeah. So my hope is that we can create a collaborative design in which long-term planning at the larger engineering scale includes the reality of plant propagation. What I mean is, you know, it might take at least 2 years and sometimes maybe more from a call or a bid for material to having the actual product in hand. And most folks in the field, they know this reality. Your growers, your restoration groups, your landscapers recognize that a large project might put out a bid for plant material and need it in 6 months, and that might not be realistic, and that might not be able to happen. And so that's when substitutes, you know, or cultivars might get worked in the system, whereas at a larger, more complex level, this gets lost in other planning factors. And so for the benefit of the growers, the landscapers, and the community groups, I hope that we can build more awareness at that landscape architect or procurement level of the timing that's actually involved with, for example, stratifying seeds before germination and all the sorts of things that different seeds of different species need in order to break dormancy, and then all the care that's necessary, you know, to get a seed to perhaps a plug or a gallon pot ready for a restoration project. And in a whole nother world that I'm not even diving into is the actual growing of seeds for projects, which is, you know, that's a long timeline as well. So I'm hoping that we can build more awareness around the time that's needed to develop this seed material and find ways to work with folks who are planning at the larger, more complex level to find creative solutions.
Are there particular practices in regenerative agriculture that you think really should be standard in both commercial agriculture and local community gardening?
Well, this is an incredibly complex ball of yarn to disentangle, and I think it can often become polarizing sometimes, but what I'll share is that I feel that if we can encourage land managers and land stewards and ourselves to continue to learn always, to consider that the complex web of relationships stretches all the way from, for example, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi in the soil to nutrient uptake to drought tolerance. And that in turn is impacting plant community abundance and diversity above ground. And that in turn is impacting beneficial invertebrate habitat, which is then also impacting pollinator sources of nectar and pollen. And this is all by virtue of robust perennial rooting systems, which also contribute to cleaner waterways and healthier humans. I think that if this sort of systems design approach can become more integrated as a norm or a standard, I think we would all be a bit better off.
So for someone who's listening, who wants to support native plant resilience in their own community, what's maybe one small thing that they can start doing today?
Yeah, so I have two small things, and those are relationships combined with responsible research. And what I mean by that is, I feel like we can't overstate the importance of building actual human connections with folks locally who are doing similar work or work that we wish we were doing. I feel like this builds momentum and energy, and that there's so much power, positive transformational power in community. And so one small thing that someone can do in the spirit of that is, you know, use the power of the internet for real good here. And Facebook or any social media outlet is going to have local groups. And if you just look up or put in your search bar, native plant nonprofit organizations near me, you will find a native plant nonprofit organization near you. And these are the sorts of groups and organizations that are fueled by people who welcome folks and want to help build community and momentum. And so that trickles down to everything from, you know, seed giveaways, plant swaps, free educational programs. And that's where you meet folks, you meet neighbors, and you start to build this plant community. And it's a really beautiful thing. So I would say the first thing to do is find a group near you who's doing this work and get involved. And then responsible research really refers to, I feel like it's incumbent on all of us to continue to keep learning and growing. And so keep learning, keep researching. What are native ecotype species near you that are native to your ecoregion? MarsBee has a wonderful species selection tool on our website for exactly that purpose. So folks can find native ecotype species, at least in our 7.5 state range, that will work really well where you are. And, you know, check your sources, challenge assumptions. And so I would say relationships and research.
So what have recent soil science findings taught us about resilience in the face of climate change?
Yeah. So I think when I speak of what I will mention here in just a moment, this isn't exactly recent soil science, but it's a part of soil biology and soil structure that is becoming, the awareness of it is becoming more and more salient recently. It's not necessarily a recent concept, but when we think of soil aggregation, which really speaks to soil's ability to withstand, for example, flood events, intense rain events, which are facets of climate change, when we speak of soil aggregation, we need to recognize that it is the bacterial communities and their glue-like byproducts, and it is the fungal communities and their glue-like byproducts that are by and large helping to glue soil particles together to create well-aggregated soil. And well-aggregated soil is a byproduct of biologically healthy soil. And without living root systems, we will be hard pressed to find that well aggregated soil over time that can withstand some of these manifestations of climate change, including these heavy weather events, these extreme weather events, this deluge and intense saturation of rainwater and floodwater. And so I think that the growing awareness around how important it is to have soil structure that can withstand these forces is really important.
And then for not everyone is familiar with the term soil aggregation. Could you like break that down for us a little bit? And maybe like, if we saw it, would we know it?
Yeah. Okay. So I think a nice way to describe soil aggregation is to describe briefly something that's called the Slakes test. And all that is if listeners can imagine that we have two mason jars filled with water, and in one mason jar, we are going to put one piece of soil. Perhaps it's a clump from one part of a field, and that part of the field has had perennial grass cover over it, really healthy field. And then in the other jar, we're going to take a clump of soil from perhaps an area that doesn't have very good vegetative cover. And we're going to put that clump of water into the soil. And what we'll see is that the clump of soil from the perennial grass-covered field, the water in that mason jar is not going to become very cloudy or dark. And the soil particles within that clump are going to hold together. They're going to stay together. Whereas the mason jar that has the clump of soil from the area without any vegetation on top, which means there's not many roots below, the water in that jar is going to become very cloudy and even muddy and very silty, and you won't be able to see through the mason jar. And essentially, that is how we can very easily on the fly determine what well-aggregated soil is and what isn't.
Yeah, that's amazing. I also love some of the stories that you hear when a farmer that's been doing perennial systems and building his soil over time, like they'll get this like massive rain event where they get 13 inches in one day and they don't even get ponding and their neighbors have a lake. So I think it's difficult to overlook this important aspect. So I love that you brought that up. What is a common challenge for native seed banks, and how are you all working to overcome them?
Yeah, so I think some of the broader challenges for native seed banks link back to some of the problems that we are trying to excavate with building out, for example, an ecoregional marketplace. So trying to figure out how do we create bridges between supply and demand, and how do we pull a lot of stakeholders together in a pretty complex process? And so that's like a broader, I think, common challenge for native seed banks. But at a more tangible level, funding is a pretty huge issue as well for native seed banks. Oftentimes, organizations are bootstrapping pretty intensely and, running on grassroots passion and chasing funding to be able to do these really important and great things for ecosystems and growers at the smaller scale. So funding, I think, is a pretty big challenge.
So, do you have an example maybe of a community or a farm or project where good collaboration led to a meaningful ecological outcome?
This is such a great question because there are so many amazing collaborations going on, not only in the Mid-Atlantic states where MarsBee works, but all over the US. And so what I can name though are the is the Xerces Society. The Xerces Society engages in incredible research and citizen science-based projects. And I think does a fabulous job of translating scientific research within the pollinator and invertebrate realm into user-friendly information that anyone can use and appreciate. The Xerces Society has fabulous resources on their website, for example, for homeowners or maybe landowners with smaller acreage who want to convert some of their land or property into whatever native meadowscape is appropriate to their ecoregion. The Xerces Society has fabulous resources. And I know that's not necessarily a collaboration, but I just think folks should know about that if they don't. And then on the more collaborative side of things, the Wild Ones, which is a national organization, has so many local chapters. And I feel like the Wild Ones does a really great job of working with other local native plant nonprofits and community groups in order to put on events and educational workshops for folks who are interested in building more momentum locally to build native plant awareness.
So, what are some of the ways that you and others are enjoying the rewards of your work?
Oh gosh. Well, I don't know if I'm going to be answering this quite correctly, but there's really nothing quite as magical or rewarding as walking through a swath of native perennial forbs slash wildflowers that are teeming with pollinators and beneficial insects in high summer. And so being able to just see that And being able to be part of the propagation of that actual vision come to life through this work is incredibly rewarding. To be able to see insects buzzing in and out of, for example, yarrow, Achillea millefolium, or bee balm, Monarda fistulosa, to smell the organic volatile oils of those plants and to know that the root systems are promoting healthy habitats below ground. It's just a wonderful thing.
I can relate. Just those smells. It always takes you back. So if your ideas, your experience, and your wisdom were all wrapped up in seeds of potential action for you to give to others, what advice would you give to aspiring ecology-minded young professionals who are looking for opportunities to make an impact in their careers and communities?
Yeah, so this is a great one. I would encourage younger ecologically minded professionals to keep seeking out opportunities to intern or volunteer. And in that vein, be willing to take the unlikely opportunity. Be willing to take the opportunity that doesn't maybe strike you immediately as what you wanted, and make it your dream. Make it the opportunity that you wanted it to be. I think always be courageous and asking questions. I think chase after your pursuits and your passions with relentless commitment while being open to asking questions and challenging assumptions, but also believe in yourself.
Great advice. So as we wrap up, is there maybe one resource, a book or a movie or a podcast that has been particularly helpful to you? Or maybe even your top three?
Yeah, thank you. So I think on the more practical side of things, I really do love pretty much everything I've ever read that comes out of Chelsea Green Publishing, but specifically the book Integrated Forest Gardening. And the full title is The Complete Guide to Polycultures and Plant Guilds and Permaculture Systems. The authors are Daniel Halsey, Bryce Ruddock, and Wayne Weissman, and I might be mispronouncing that last name, but this is a beautiful book. It's very user-friendly, and it is chock full of helpful information for folks who want to dig into forest gardening and really working with plant guilds and permaculture systems. And so a lot of native ecotype species information and knowledge is provided in this book, but is also a companion to, for example, the species lists that MarsBee has on our website. And another book is The Ecological Farm by Helen Atthau, which is an incredible book for anyone who wants to dig into all facets of growing and producing any crops, fruit trees, vegetables, herbs, cut flowers at a very ecological scale. And so this book walks you through, for example, creating mineral extracts from what folks refer to as weeds in order to create mineral plant sprays for your fruit trees or your perennial crops. And so in any event, those are two amazing books that are well worth the investment in the book. And then the last book I want to mention is, it's less of a practical guide, but one of the most well-written books I have ever read. And it's Death and Life of the Great Lakes by Dan Egan. And this book chronicles really the ecological demise of the Great Lakes. And it feels like this book spans epochs. And it is so dense and full of such great information. And it also provides readers with hope. And the author chronicles, you know, bioengineering and green solutions that are now being utilized to help restore the Great Lakes. But it's a beautiful book, and it's incredible. It's sad, it's hopeful, and it's just very smart.
Excellent. I love the hopeful part.
Yes.
So thank you so very much for taking the time to share this with us.
Thank you so much, Jenny. Yeah, it's been really fun being here, and I appreciate it.
If you haven't yet visited your local Green Online Hub, then please visit gogreenlocally.org and check out the directories for events, groups, businesses, online resources, and local support listings for your area. If you find something is missing, then let us know or just log in and add it. These are community free sharing directories.